This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run a backdoor play if they can get it. Under 10. Backdoor. Who's out? Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
We're at the Broadcast Center in Princeton, New Jersey with Hoops Hour with Henderson. And I'm joined today by a very special guest to me, a friend, an alum, class of 98, Sean Gregory. Sean is senior writer at Time Magazine. Obviously, we played together here at Princeton. He's been had appearances on the Today Show, CBS This Morning, CNN New Day, recently MSNBC doing a segment on Muhammad Ali, Morning Joe, Hardball with Chris Matthews. Sean, I don't know what you haven't done, but first, you know, from the Bronx, went to Fordham Prep, mm-hmm. and son of a cop. Mm-hmm. Walk me through, you know, what life was like for you growing up in the Bronx, and a little bit of your path with basketball.
Yeah, so we lived in a two-family house in the bottom level, the lower level, and. My dad was a cop. My mom was an office administrator. And my whole family, my dad played at LIU in the late 70s. My aunt played at Fordham University. She's their all-time leading scorer. Her number's retired there.
I always wondered who taught you how to shoot.
No, it was really myself. I just had this lefty, goofy, terrible form when I was in 7th, 8th grade.
I should have mentioned in the intro that you were extremely left-handed.
Yes.
For those that don't know you, but it's goofy, but it goes in a lot.
Well, that's very nice. But yeah, so when I was in like 7th, 8th grade, my knee, I was kind of famous in around the Bronx parishes for my knee would hit the ground. So I would bend down to shoot and my knee would actually hit the ground. Because I wasn't strong enough really to shoot like a regular person. So, and my dad, you know, so we'd play. My dad would play. And then my dad and all his high school friends played like a weekly pickup game at their old high school. And
where was this?
This was in Monsignor Scanlon High School in the Bronx. Back then it was called St. Helena's when he was going there. And one of the most fun experiences I remember is – I should have mentioned my uncle, my dad's brother, played at Manhattan College. So when I was in, I used to go there and be like a little running around and shoot in between games and just kind of where I, you know, would watch them play and really picked up a lot of love for basketball. And then finally, when I was in 8th grade, I got to play in one of these pickup games. And at one point, I think it was me, my aunt, my uncle, my dad, and some 5th person. So it was fun to kind of have that family moment, and you feel like, yeah, you've kind of arrived a little bit as a basketball player when you get to play with, you know, 35-year-old adults. You know, like yeah. You think that's a big deal when you're an 8th.
Well, I recently heard an interview with Bill Walton where he's like, basketball is the ultimate. You know, if you're worthy, you're going to play.
Yeah,
and you know that sounds like you were.
Yeah,
you were,
I think
they recognized something at a young age,
and it was nice because there were some hardcore. You know, cop, firemen, competitors, and they would not have wanted you out there if you were ruining the game. So by the time I was 13, 14, I think I was good enough not to be a huge liability and ruin what was a weekly tradition that, you know, continued when these guys, they were in their 30s then. I think they were playing until their, you know, I think it recently ended. And even after college, I would go and kind of rekindle that youthful, you know. The beauty of basketball is it's just – it connects people. And mm-hmm. It sounds corny, but it's kind of true.
Oh, that's very true. And you attended Fordham Prep, and there's this great picture. It's actually at the Fordham Prep gym, the Donnie Walsh Court.
Yes, right? The Donnie Walsh
Court. Of the all-time leading scorers in Fordham Prep basketball history, Tom Kelly. Donnie Walsh, former president of the Knicks, was with the Pacers for a long time. Is up there. Tommy Haig, a very good baseball player here at Princeton. Yep. Jimmy Walsh, Donnie Walsh's brother. Frank McLaughlin, the coach at Harvard and the longtime AD at Fordham
University.
And then Sean Gregory.
Yeah. They recently unveiled that. And, of course, somebody took a picture and put on Facebook. And it wasn't from I couldn't do it because it would be like, hey, I'm the ninth leading scorer at Florida Prep. But somebody else did it. And it was funny. There was top 10 leading scorers, and I was number 9. And I only played 2 years on the varsity. So I like to say I might have been a little higher if I had made the varsity.
You and Michael Jordan, right?
Yeah, right, right.
Somebody and, holding you back.
And but they didn't have a 10th. I don't know if they couldn't find who number 10 was, or they're just waiting for somebody to knock me off the list or something. So I feel bad for the number 10 leading, all-time leading scorer at Florida Prep because nobody knows who it is. They couldn't count. I don't know how they put that together. Anyway, it was just kind of it was a fun night. And yeah, I mean, you know, listen, you don't want to be the person who relives in your high school glory days, but to, you know, to see your name up there with some pretty good company. And, you know, Donnie Walsh being up there, he's so well-known and respected in the NBA. It got
a lot of really, you know, kind of guys that have gone on to some really special things in basketball in that group. You know, I want to talk about your time at Princeton, but, you know, you and I, you've talked before about, you know, how you got recruited to Princeton and Coach Carmody's visit up to Fordham Prep. Maybe you could
walk through. It's kind of a, you know, you know, games changed our lives, right? And for me, it was really a high school game that changed the direction of my life. We, at Fordham Prep, we had this rival school, Archbishop Stepanak, who I think now has some really good players, by the way. And they, my career, we were 0-9 against them over my 4 years going into a playoff game up at Mount St. Michael. And they were 22-1 that year. It was the semifinals of this the Catholic League Division II. And so we were 0-9, never could beat them. They were awesome. And we go up to this game, and Princeton wasn't on the radar at this point. I was going to hopefully go to Columbia. Basically, that was my goal. And Princeton, I had no contact with Princeton at all. I mean, I'd sent them letters, and I'd heard Kirill used to roll his eyes when people would bring my name up to him and stuff. And so it wasn't nowhere on the radar. And so we go up there and think probably my last game of my high school career. And I'm thinking I'm going to Columbia. And somehow we have one of these games where, and, you know, somebody taped and we used to watch it all the time. It was like our Hoosiers moment. You know what I mean? It was like one of my teammates was hitting everything. I hit this like half court shot at the end of the first half, and then I like run and like jump over a chain in the locker room doing all this corny stuff. It was all this like, and we wound up winning the game and getting to the championship, and Coach Carmody came to the championship game at St. John's. And so luckily I didn't know he was going to be there because I probably would have freaked out and had a terrible game, but we lost, but I had a pretty good game. I think I scored 31 or 32 points, although as Coach Carmody mentioned on his recruiting call to me, I didn't make any threes, and he kind of yelled at me about that. And so
did he tell you you were too skinny?
Yeah. I mean, the recruiting call was – so I hear – after the fact, I hear that Coach Carmody was at this game, and he's going to call me. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is the moment. And, you know, I had made the all – Archdiocese and team, you know, this is my, so he calls me up and is like, hey, you know, you're not bad. This is probably a bad coach.
No, that's actually pretty good. I think it's good.
And, you know, you get some, you have a nose for the basket, but you know, you're pretty weak. You're really skinny. I'm like, yeah, sorry. I am. He's like, and you didn't make any threes. You missed a few threes. And I'm like, well, I had made some threes a few games ago. I wish you were at that game. You know, it's just like, and it was so like in the Princeton Coach Kirill, Coach Carmody, that whole era meld of brutal honesty. And it wasn't a recruiting call. It was more like, all right, we have another spot. Come down and visit and we'll see what happens.
Right. A little bit of a sign of things to come.
Yes.
Potentially.
And it was, I just remember hanging up and like my dad was so excited. My parents were so excited. And, you know, Princeton was a huge, I mean, we had, you know, my dad went to LIU. The Ivy League wasn't really anything kind of in our you know, background or family tree. So to get a call from the coach of Princeton, and I had known Princeton's history at the time. This was 1994, and so they just won the league 4 times. The Georgetown game made everything legendary. And so this was a huge deal to get a call from the assistant coach. So I go to, I met Darren Hite, our teammate, at Columbia the weekend before. I went down to Princeton on like a Tuesday night. So I was like a Tuesday night recruit, you know what I mean? And so I find out Darren was being recruited by Princeton. And then I'd heard about this kid from Long Island who was a good shooter, kind of played the same position. His name was James Mastalio. Mm-hmm. And then there was another guy, a lefty, another lefty was going to maybe play small forward, Dove Barnett, mm-hmm. Who played up in Riverdale High School up in the city. So I know. So here I am hearing about all these other like three men that Princeton's recruiting to hopefully replace this guy named Chris Mooney, who played for 4 years. And so it was like, all right, so you're one of four people and you're going to come down on a Tuesday night and, you know, and I stayed with Chris Mooney and Mike Brennan, who, you know, are now mm-hmm. very successful coaches. And they were done, to their credit, they were so nice, but they were also like done hosting every, I mean, you and Steve Goodrich hosted every recruit. They were hosting every recruit and they were so nice, but it was a Tuesday night in April. They were done their theses. It was like, they were so done. And so I remember being on the recruiting trip and it was very like, you know, just hanging out in the room. And so frankly, I kind of had more fun at Columbia because it was like a weekend, but you know, but I get down, and Coach Kerr was just so honest, and like I learned so much. So in the old offices, I watched a tape of that Stepanak game, our big upset, and I thought my little half court shot was such a great deal. You know, like, oh look, I can shoot, and they were like, dude, you hit a lucky shot at the end of the first half. You know what I mean? They were like, hey, that doesn't matter. Like, you know, that doesn't happen in a game.
Let me bring you right back.
Oh, here. Man. And then I had gotten beat back door at one point, and they just had fun pointing that
don't
out.
Don't you think, though, that and, you know, obviously we both played for Coach Carroll. We both played for Coach Carmody.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do talk about this with my staff now, in that you call it the culture of brutal honesty.
Yeah.
But there, in that truth telling, wasn't there some? There's an element in there of sort of making you a part of the team.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You know, I felt like, you know, I remember Coach Kirill, as I took the train back, sitting with me at the train station, just being like, you know, you're not a bad kid. You know, like just laying it all out. Like, it's going to be hard for you, but you know, we think you got something. And if you come here, you work. You know, you'll never. You know, it might work out. Mm-hmm. And it was
sounds like a pivotal moment.
It was just like he was sitting with me, like this legendary coach is sitting with me at the train. Like, okay, he cares enough to kind of see me off. And
you haven't mentioned it, but you know, and I'm yeah. sorry to cut you off.
No.
I, you know, academically, you know, it, you know. At the time, the Woodrow Wilson School was a selective
right.
part of Princeton University's process. So not only did you play basketball, but you were you accepted to Princeton and then you accepted into the Woodrow Wilson School of International mm-hmm. Policy. And, you know, I have distinct memories of watching you go about your process of, you know, the time it takes to be a student athlete mm-hmm. at Princeton isn't easy. Mm-hmm. But excelling. Could you explain to me some of your challenges
yeah.
being a student athlete and then maybe even talk about, you know, now you're on the other side, you're interviewing athletes all the time. You're talking
right.
And I want to get to that part here soon, but tell me about that. Like, what was that? Explain to me what that process was like for you and the challenges.
Yeah. You know, I struggled my first semester freshman year just, you know, adjusting to the workload and the practice time and being tired and eating meals at 8 o'clock up on Nassau Street because our practices went way long. And then I took some classes.
We can't get in trouble for that at this point.
Statutes of limitations yes. are done. And then I just kind of found a subject area. I had no idea what Woodrow Wilson was coming in here. I thought I might be a Latin major or a math major, not knowing that being a math major at Princeton, you have to be, you know, your IQ has to be totally off the charts. So, but I found like studying cities and studying government kind of spring of my freshman year, I found like, oh, this is kind of an interesting area. And so, yeah, I mean, the work that goes into it for me, I remember watching our friend Steve Goodrich, who's just, I think just has one of those sponge brains and, you know, works hard, but just kind of, I was always like, man, like, how does he do it? Like, he just goes about his business. But for me, it was always, I had to study. I had to really, like, maybe over-prepare, maybe compensate for not being the 1500 SAT guy. And so, you know, I was very focused on doing well in school and doing the best I could on the court and having a little fun. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, later – jumping around a little bit. In my journalism career, that kind of somewhat worked against me because a lot of journalists do journalism in college. It's the one career that you can actually do when you're 19 years old. You can't be a lawyer when you're 19 years old. You can't be a doctor when you're 19 years old, but you can write a story for the student paper when you're 19 years old. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of not pursue that with the passion and the rigor that some of my classmates that have gone on to very good journalism careers earlier in their career, you know, they came out and were right. So, but at the same time, I would not have traded what I did for anything else because of the experience that we had, the team that we had, and the challenge of doing the academic work. I never felt like it was a waste. Like, oh, you studied really hard in some statistics class and you got a good grade, but you never use it now. Well, no, at the time, it's like you want to the task in front of you. You have to kind of live in the moment and attack that.
Yeah. And I think about you often whenever I talk with our current guys, in terms of what's required, what's actually required weekly, daily, to be. And there's lots of different levels of success, but academic focus and then also the basketball focus. You know, I saw you and watched you, you know, put your week together. And that's often one of the questions that we hear and I hear in recruiting is what's it like? What's a week like? And I would agree. You know, I would say that your preparation at Princeton allowed you and the fact that you were a student athlete. And now – and we're going to get into this, the amount of – the people that you interview, I think it's given you a different perspective than maybe somebody that started writing at 19.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, no, it definitely I know I went through something special when I talked to athletes and coaches, particularly in basketball, there's an instant credibility for folks who know Princeton basketball. And you know, the interesting thing about Princeton basketball for me is, you know, I'm one of those guys who, you know, I didn't play that much here. I wasn't a great player. I, you know, was a practice guy whose job most of the time was to, you know, be on the scout team and help you guys succeed and us as a team succeed. And, but I still had a great experience because, you know, of what we accomplished together. And the Princeton Basketball Association, when you get out in the world, it doesn't matter whether you are the starting two guard or, you know, the 13th guy. It's you know that you went through a process. They know the coach was Coach Kirill, what he built up and the uniqueness of how we played as a team and defended and all this stuff. So there's an instant like credibility that's basically helped me get to everywhere I've been, just having that attachment. So, you know, as people kind of think about coming, you know, and that has sustained itself through the years. So, you know, if you're thinking of coming here, you know, not everybody's going to be a star. And I'm one of those guys, I'm basically saying like, I'm one of those guys where, like, if you know you're going to come here and you're going to do something special, and even if you don't get in the game as much as you would like, you can have an unbelievable experience. And it can really – I mean, like, I'm a living example of how it's really helped me in every phase of my life get started, particularly in journalism.
Yeah. Well, and I want to go there now. And you mentioned Columbia Journalism School. And I don't want to skip ahead too much, but Sandy Padway was a mentor of yours there.
Yeah.
And I remember you telling a story – shortly or right around September 11th, and it was sort of after Columbia Journalism School and kind of how you got associated with Time, how you found Time, and an editor at Time had seen a piece that you had done on September 11th.
Right.
So you haven't always been a sports writer.
No.
And, you know, of course, you go to journalism school, no experience.
No experience.
And explain to me what that was like, and then talk me through, you know, your arrival at Time, you know, after you started Columbia Journalism.
Well, just want to just backtrack a little bit just to talk about the Princeton connection. Was I met Alex Wolf, who's
writer at Sports Illustrated.
Writer at Sports Illustrated at the time, a Princeton alum, had written about Coach, you know, new Coach Kirill, huge basketball, their head college basketball writer. I met him when I was in high school through a family connection. And so that already gave me kind of a relationship when I was 18 years old. And I didn't really do much journalism in college because of what we – but the one thing I – before our senior year, we went on this trip to Italy, and I wrote this this diary.
The famous diary.
Right. Well, I'm famous. Thank you. But it was basically a blog that in 1997 we didn't know what a blog was. So like 3 weeks after I got back, we wrote this thing for the media guide, and it got pretty good attention. It gave me confidence that I could – that I could write. But since I had no experience, I needed a job. And, you know, that's that year, our senior year, we were so enveloped in basketball that I wasn't totally thinking. I was trying to enjoy that experience so much. So I just basically – I wasn't, like, sending resumes all over the place to try to get a journalism job that I probably wouldn't get because I had no experience. So it's, I just took a job in finance for a few years anyway. And then Alex and had helped me get to Sports Illustrated as like a fact checker.
I love how you just glossed over your time in finance.
Yeah.
Anyways.
We could go back to that. But and then so through all these connections, I wind up – they're like a good – I find out that the way to get to in my position was grad school. And so I had met some people, and it all started with Alex. I met some people who told me about this guy, Sandy Padway, who was a longtime editor at Sports Illustrated, a longtime teacher at Columbia.
What and was he, why was he good?
He's just gruff. He was one of these old-fashioned, wavy, gray hair, old school. He was a sports columnist in Philadelphia in like the 60s and 70s. You know, knew Muhammad Ali. Grew up in the when in the 60s when sports and sociology and social issues were intersecting, and you know, and sports was a living, breathing microcosm of society, and just was like a hardcore worker. And, you know, I met him before I went to school, and I showed him my little diary. I was so proud of it, you know, like, look, I'm not a bad writer. And he was like, well, that's not journal. You know, he was basically dismissed it. Like, that's you and your friends writing about a little travelogue. Huh? And that's very nice, but it's not like going out in the street and talking to people. And so early, it's a 1 year thing. I got in his class, and it was 9/11, the fall of 2001. And that day, we were all supposed to go cover the New York mayoral primary. We all had little neighborhoods that we would
– What was your neighborhood?
It was the South Bronx, Longwood in the South Bronx. So I was on my way to the voting hall in the South Bronx. So I'm on the one train going down the city, and I took another train up to the Bronx, the city being Manhattan, and I see the smoke and I see people yelling. It's like, what's going on? And then I hear that the tower's been hit. And so my being such a rookie, I'm thinking, oh my God, well, I still have to get out to the Bronx. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of had no idea of like what with the severity of it at the moment. Then I get off the train. I'm like, wait a second. Like, my brother works in the area. I'm like, who do I know down there? And it's like, all right, now I got to start worrying a little bit. So I call – the cell phones aren't working. I call my dad. You know, the call's not going through, Finally, I get through. I'm in a cab. Somehow I got a cab because the train stopped running at like 145th Street. I get in a cab on my way to the Bronx, seeing all this stuff going on. And I get through to my dad. He's like, he's okay. He's walking from the World Trade Center area up, and you know, he had like kind of seen, I think he was walking to his job in the financial center and the planes hit. And we've never really talked about it that heavily, but as I understand it, you know, there was debris flying. He saw debris flying all over the place, whether it almost hit him and stuff, you know. And, but, you know, I think it was pretty traumatic. And so he's walking home, and now I'm at the bridge of, going into – so there's a bridge going from Manhattan into the Bronx. So I was in the Bronx at my primary location. Obviously, we scrapped that. Sandy Padway, I get on the phone with him. He's like, be a journalist now, you know. You got to write a story. And I'm like, well, I'm at this incredible scene of all these people flowing out of Manhattan into the Bronx, basically walking home up to the suburbs. They have no way to get home. And so just talk to people about what happened. Yeah. Paint that picture. And then at the end – and at the end, Kevin, my brother, is – on the similar
so you
journey.
See him walking.
Yeah. So it's like I knew he was coming, but that was like the story at the end. I kind of put in the personal narrative, and my brother's here, and he's telling the story. And so it was a crash course in like putting together a story in a very traumatic situation. I had known some people. I didn't have any like relatives or like close friends involved, but I knew some people who lost their lives and stuff. So it was very mixed emotions and hard. And so, yeah, I wrote this story, and when it was time for me to apply for internships and stuff, and I wrote the story because Sandy Padway, getting back to the original question, was this guy's like, don't go home and just wallow and watch the news. You're a journalist now. And so, that story, I did it, and I submitted it with other stuff, and it got the attention of the hiring editor at Time. And that's how I got my summer internship at Time. When I had, I was looking for internships, jobs, and it was like, Time Inc. internship form. What are your three top publications? I'm like, number one, Sports Illustrated, obviously. Like, I kind of know some people there. That's where I want to work. And then I'm like, well, they're not going to pick number two or three. So who cares what two or three is, right? I mean, there's 500 people applying for all these internships. No one's going to – if you're the hiring editor at Time and somebody puts Time as their second choice, they're going to throw it away. And so I put Time second because I thought it'd be interesting. I think I put Fortune or something third. And I get this call in May, or I should say March, 2 months before I'm about to graduate and have no job or anything. And they're like, you've been hired as an intern at Time Magazine. No interview, no nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what just happened? Like, yes, yes. And I found out later that the hiring editor – at Time, a woman named Jane Bachman Wolf, longtime hiring editor at Sports Illustrated, saw the story, caught her eye. I had done some temp work kind of at SI earlier. She calls up the hiring editor there. It's like, who's this guy, Sean Gregory? They say, he's a capable person. Yeah. And
here you are 15 years later.
Yeah, I got the internship 3 months, and I was with other college kids. I was 26 at the time because I'd worked 3 years in finance. So I was one of these interns who was older than everybody. I had a full-time job at 3 years on Wall Street. Now I'm an intern at a magazine. And the advantage I had is that they needed bodies around after the summer, and I had nowhere to go. Everyone else went back to school. So I was a temp worker for a while through the year. And then at the end of the year, it was like, we have no more money to pay you. You have to – there's this job at Sports Illustrated for kids. And I interviewed and got an offer, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. There's a newspaper job up in New London, Connecticut that I went for. And I think I had a – I don't know if I got the offer, but I think they wanted me to be on their news side. I wanted to be a sports writer. So I wanted to be a sports writer. My options were Sports Illustrated for kids and – covering cops in New London, Connecticut. I'm like, where am I? Like, what's going to happen? Like, it was not pleasant. And then I was trying to decide, and over Christmas vacation in 2002, I get a call from Jane Bachman Wolf, who's been like my guardian angel in this whole thing.
Yes, sounds like it.
And she says, you know what? Somebody just left or something, and we have a position for you. And it was like, wow. Yeah. And even then it was uncertain because I don't know, I was starting out at the very bottom of Time and you had to go through this process, but you fact check and are you going to get to write and all this stuff. But the nice part about Time that I discovered is the hierarchy is pretty flat. And so if you're good and you can prove you're going to work and put in the extra work.
That's what I want to talk about is sort of you mentioned, kind of the beginnings of your journalism process, but, for those of us that know you, have seen you at work and kind of, you're a left-handed, which I mentioned, and how do I say this in the right way? You're right in the margins, you're sort of all over the place sometimes, but so explain to me that guy you just described, then the evolution of, okay, here we are. We're sitting here in 2016. You just did in the last week. If you Google Time Magazine, Sean Gregory, right? There's an article on rugby, on Rory McIlroy's coming. Not going to Rio Olympics. Muhammad Ali, LeBron James, Steph Curry deciding not to go to the Olympics. I mean, literally every major sports story is written by you on Time.com. So, what's the process like? How do you go from that guy to where you are now and a confident, and this is probably a question that a lot of 18, 19-year-olds like you in 1995 would be like, I want what that guy does.
it's you learn the work ethic that you – I think a lot of journalism is just showing up and putting in the time, like making the call and making the extra call. And so for me, I learned a lot of that here, basically, you know, like just you're going to have to put in the hours. You're going to have to go to practice. You're going to have to suffer through the scout team and Coach Kirill yelling at you and all that kind of stuff.
No, not Coach.
And so that really helped me. And being on Wall Street, frankly, you have to put in so you have to put in those hours too. So it just helped me have a sense of I've just got to get the job done. You know, not to
so you attribute it to the a work ethic.
Oh, like yeah,
grinding it out.
You
mentioned it was flat.
Right.
Is there any moment in particular that you felt like that you arrived that this was a particularly powerful moment for you as a you were just like a month where you were like. You know, you hit singles for a while, and then all of a sudden you start to hit.
Yeah, that's a great
doubles and triples.
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, it was.
So that's a good. I'm glad I finally asked a good question because, like, how many athletes have said to you or people? Well, that's a good question.
Oh no, they do, usually, and it always makes you feel. Yeah, a lot of times they don't, but you got to.
I was going to give you the non-question with the the no question mark at the end.
Yeah.
Like, tell me about. So you're left-handed,
and then that just silent.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, Mitch, I am left-handed.
Yes.
But no, and I, because it made me think, and the answer to that question is for me in 2005, I kind of turned a little corner where, there's something else I thought about, but in 2005, I had done a bunch of stories. It was the steroid hearing in baseball. I did a LeBron James story when he was on the Cavs.
These were shortly after he had arrived in the league.
In the league. I did one of the first time profiles on him. I think I did a Super Bowl story. It was a McNabb New England Super Bowl story. Like our sports editor, at the time, Jim Kelly at the time, wasn't a huge sports fan. So it wasn't easy to get these things in the magazine. And after that winter and spring, I had a succession of stories in the magazine that were sports related. And he took me out to lunch, was like, hey, who are you? I don't like sports, but we keep running your stuff. And so I did this golf story about the rivalry between Tiger and Phil Mickelson and Vijay Singh. I went and kind of went down to Florida and talked to all these golfers and got like gossip about what he thinks about this one and this one and this one. And so it was like this like lunchroom clicky story and it wound up being a lot of fun to write.
Mm-hmm.
And then interviewed Maria Sharapova that summer. So that was kind of and the steroid hearings with McGuire, that was on a tight deadline. And so that was kind of where, they need to trust you to not, when you're writing on deadline, to not be a terrible writer and they don't want to do a ton of work to lift you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still, I think my editor would tell you that, I'm far from perfect and need work still, but like it's not where it's a liability. So that was a big thing for me. And the other thing for me was the internet, basically,
because time basically went. Again, following your career, but when sort of left the shelves and in a way, and you guys sort of arrived online, and at the time it was like ESPN Sports and Yahoo Sports,
right.
And Time Sports. Where were you going to go to get your sports information?
Yeah, and so when I started at Time, it was a weekly magazine, and there were all these reporters who used to feed reporting to writers. It was a very inefficient system. So you would file. I remember when there was a blackout in New York City. I interviewed Bloomberg. I did all this kind of New York. It was a blackout all over the Eastern Seaboard,
mm-hmm.
And I did the kind of New York City stuff. And there was a long story written by Nancy Gibbs, who's now the editor, was an unbelievable writer. And so like 20 people file her reporting and she uses like a sentence of what you're doing. Well, now all that stuff that you do that feed into a big story all are their own stories on time.com.
Yeah. I mean, right. Like you're essentially prolific enough to say that, you're almost a daily you.
Well, yeah.
You're doing a little bit longer stories right now, right?
Yeah, but we're always and the challenge is dividing your time up to see what you should be doing for the magazine, what you should be doing for online. Figuring mm-hmm. that balance out is really the trick. I kind of discovered that the internet in 2007, 2008. There was a shift internally at Time where it was like, you guys have to write online more. And there was some resistance to that. But for me, I was like, it's a chance to write. Because when I started at Time, the fear was like, you'll never get to write. You know what I mean? Because it's a weekly magazine. There's all these writers. I'm just starting out. Like, I'll never write. But but when the internet came around, even when I was writing more for the magazine, it was like, oh, man, I can do all these different stories. And they'll get attention. And they'll get attention. Even if they don't run in the magazine. Yeah, like, having a story online that doesn't run in the magazine is perfectly fine.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about the magazine. And I might be skipping forward. And I do want to cover a couple different things. But, you know, you had a cover. You've had a couple. But
a few,
like,
yeah.
A few.
I wish I had more, but a few.
No, a few. But in particular, the one is it's a picture of Johnny Manziel on the cover,
right,
and I think the quote is, "Should college athletes be paid?" And there's a lot of work that goes into the cover pieces.
Yeah.
Explain what a cover in the magazine story. How does it, walk me through that?
Yeah, I mean, that particular story was a, it was iterative in the sense that like you hand this in, you think it's good, and it gets torn apart by this editor. There's more eyes on it when it's the cover. And so it goes through a real ringer of a process. And it's stressful. It's worrisome. It's like, oh, my. I remember that before that cover came out, it was all closed into the printer, and I was going for a jog the night before. And I thought, oh, wait a second. SEC. Is it the Southeast or Southeastern Conference? What did I write? Did I write it wrong? I'm going to offend everybody in the SEC. And then I went and looked at a copy and I saw that I spelt it. I think it's the Southeast Conference or South. I'm going to get it wrong now. But like I looked up. I'm like, it was like this huge relief that I like got that right. You know what I mean? So all this different thing, these different things. And that cover was at the time, it was 2013, the paying college athletes was hugely in the news, thanks to Manziel. Now, obviously, you know, him as the poster boy for this now doesn't look that great. Obviously, his career has gone a different way. But at the time, I think he was the perfect character for that because he had just signed some autographs and got in trouble for it. And instead of the reaction at the time being Johnny Manziel's a cheater, it's like, why shouldn't he sign autographs and make money, right? I mean, and
Jake, what was your take on it?
Oh, yeah, college athletes
you've
got
to provide and you've got to toe the line. But what would be – we're sitting here and we're having a discussion. Like what would be your
I'm paying
opinion.
College athletes?
Yeah.
Yeah, it hasn't changed. Yeah, they should be. I think – and the – you know, we propose a system where there's a salary cap and you don't have to pay college athletes. But if the SEC wants to pay college athletes and maybe set a salary cap and each conference can set salary caps and – But our big argument was not even if the colleges don't want to pay you, that's fine. It's why shouldn't you be able to go out and get a sponsorship if you're that valuable? Like, you know, coaches can do it. Anybody else can do it. You or I can do it. Why can't a college quarterback go do a college or sign autographs? So that's where that came out. And you know, people on the other side, you know, as soon as that cover went up, it was like Time's idiotic. Mm-hmm. Time's got it wrong. Time's falling for the trap. There's no way these guys should be paid. And other people were like, oh, finally Time catches on. The college athletes should be paid.
I think it's safe to say that you would have been sponsored by Hoagie Hill. No?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and then getting back, you know, because there's also, you've mentioned the website, but also you've enjoyed some popularity on, kind of a YouTube kind of a
thing. Yeah,
if you YouTube Sean Gregory synchronized swimming. Now, this is, I've got to indulge the listeners because this is incredible. There's literally, let me just read these things off. So Tough Mudder.
Yes, I've done
which is my personal favorite because you get electrically shocked at the end and you let out a little
and
scream.
And I chug a beer at the end.
You do. There's a little Sean Gregory scream in there at the end. You synchronized swimming, you're in the pool with actual synchronized swimmers in 2012. This is in advance of the Beijing Olympics.
Yes, I put a clip on my nose.
Clip on your nose. We've seen it. And it's supposed to be like graceful above the water and a flurry underneath. And I would say it was a flurry above the water and flurry underneath. And then the trampoline, which is, I think, in training for the
– It was – we did a Winter Olympics. It was an aerial skier. I bounced on the trampoline, my knee and my chin.
And you knocked yourself out. We can't do this because this is a podcast, but these are must. This is must watch if you don't know Sean. But so – you're now doing video, and again, I mentioned this before. A different part of your career is taking off here, where you're now in front of the TV.
Right, and I had no idea. You know, you study to be a print reporter, you're at Time Magazine, and I had going in 2002, no idea that stuff would be a thing, and that stuff is so much fun. And I get such a reaction out of that. And they get viewed. I also did this thing with Kobe Bryant.
Oh, free lesson with
free
Kobe.
Free lesson. So I had this idea, like, let's ask famous people to just talk, you know, big athletes to talk about how they do a how they do basic stuff. And somehow
and Kobe's walking you through, like, Kobe, his jab steps.
Somehow he did this, you know? And it's the most viewed time clip on YouTube ever. I think it might be close to 4 million views or whatever it is. Like, ever, by far. It's because it's timeless. You know, any dad can be like, you know, hey, Kobe, learn how Kobe does a foul shot. It was very basic stuff, and he was into it. And it was one of my first ones, and I kept nodding. Like, the producer was like, don't say uh-huh when you're on video because it interrupts. Yeah. You could do it in your private interviews, but it interrupts when there's – and so I kept – they're like, just nod. So instead of just, like, nodding a little bit, I was like a bobblehead. So all the comments were like, how much of a bobblehead am I?
But I think all of us have unfortunately given you way too many pointers. Like one morning on the Today Show, I think we were – talking about how you were wearing a jacket that was maybe a couple sizes too big.
Oh, yeah. It was like draped over me and Al Roker made fun of me or something. It was but that video stuff.
But yeah, that's part of the charm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. And those clips, I did the hot dog eating contest and
I almost threw up,
you know, like.
And who was the famous hot dog eater?
It was like Joey Chestnut.
Joey Chestnut.
Yeah, it was just in the back
what
of the Nathan's.
What was his secret? How did he get so many?
I think he practiced and I don't know. Like, he just had some kind of stomach muscle that worked. And that was, like, in the back of a Nathan's near Penn Station. The onions and the relish were disgusting. And I hate – anyway. But that stuff was, like – I got more reaction, especially from my friends. Like, you guys all enjoy that because you get to make fun of me. And
everyone's living and vicariously through you. You are – you know, again, here we've started at the beginning, but we're arriving at the stuff that we both know it took a while to get here.
Yeah.
So you're a former student athlete, and you're again, I just walked. If I just took the last week of what you've done, but let me just jump back just a little bit. You did an article right before Steph Curry. You had dinner with Steph Curry,
right?
Out in this is pre first MVP.
No, this was after he won the championship.
Okay.
This was this winter. Thanksgiving,
okay,
around
great.
Thanksgiving this year.
So you're sitting down with arguably the most popular athlete in the United States. And unfortunately, just we're taping this right after they lose the NBA championship. But does being a former athlete give you the confidence to ask the kind of questions? Because I know you're going into that and being like, and jumping back, you and I talked about Maria Sharapova, like an article where she was very forthcoming about how she had grown 2 inches after the 2004 Wimbledon.
Right.
What's the aha moment with Steph Curry? How do you ask him a question that no one knows the answer? And this is time.
Right.
Right. This is – you guys are a little different.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'll bring it back to Princeton basketball. Like, the way I cut the ice with him was that his GM, Bob Myers, played in the UCLA game. And
1996,
right,
Princeton, UCLA.
And got in the game for like 2 minutes and didn't do anything, which is the concept of a trillion. You play 2 minutes and you have all zeros. And so it was Bob Myers had a trillion. And so the PR guy from the Warriors thinks this is funny, tells this to Curry. And then I tell Curry, yeah, a trillion, it's like when you get a few minutes, you don't do anything. And he's like laughing. And I'm like, when I was at school, I played at Princeton, didn't play much, and we used to make, count who had the most trillions at the end of the year, and then we'd have a party and give him a fake crown, and he's just, like, laughing. He's like, and so that instantly, put it at, all right, I'm not, some maniac who's going to be uncomfortable. Like, I'm not you as a basketball player, but I went through something in your world. And then, and then it just gets it just kind of breaks the ice a little bit.
Let's talk about his world.
He was so, at the time, it was one of those, you don't know what's going to happen. He's super famous and we're in a restaurant. Is he going to be distracted? Is he going to be, are people going to mob him and make the conversation stilted? And he just had a glass of wine and was relaxed and gave me an hour of really undivided attention. And, he's not the most controversial, quotable guy in the world, but he talks a lot and he explains, his process. And the headline quote out of that was his confidence in saying, I'm I think I asked him, it's a question that you want to get the quote out of. Are you the best player in the world? You know, that kind of thing. And I think he didn't say, I am the best player in the world. But he's like, yeah, I have to think I am. Da, da, da. And then, you know.
His confidence.
The confidence. And then, you know, people read that and it's like, Steph Curry says he's the best player in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and that kind of gets, you know, the pickup. So he was, you know, for a guy at the, you know, it was, they were just started their 24 game, I think it was 24, the season starting winning streak, and they were in the middle of it, and he could have easily been dismissive, but it was like, hey, let's just, I'm going to have dinner with you, and and no distractions, and he was, and I left, I think I texted you after that, like, so happy, like, this guy's amazing, he's, look how he plays.
I was texting you during the whole
thing. And it was like.
Ask him how he makes 30 free shots.
Yeah, right. We're talking about changes in baskets, so it was just one of those experiences, like, you're done with that, and you're like, I'm a very lucky person, like, because there's so much uncertainty, and then something works out, it's probably not unlike a basketball game where you win, right? I mean, you get a win. You know, if you're going to win or you lose, you win, you feel good.
You describe yourself as lucky. You say, you know, like, I was fortunate to sort of get into these things. But, you know, it's I think from afar, you know, watching you it's been work. It's been who you are. And I love the story. You know, here we are on the sort of on the cusp of the Rio Olympics, but – you have this amazing story about handball from Beijing.
Yeah. No.
Explain the handball story.
Yeah. No. And this
is you in a nutshell.
Well, right. So, and this is all about like just going up. You never know what's going to happen in this profession and in our lives. And it's just so. Anyway, I was in Beijing and I had this story idea of, you know,
covering the Olympics.
Covering the Olympics. It's like I need a story kind of every day. Like, you know, it'd be a fun story. Why isn't America good at handball? Handball is a sport that's big in Europe. It's basically you take a ball, you're allowed maybe two steps. It's like soccer with your hands. It's like if you're strong and you can throw a ball hard into the net.
Fun game to watch.
Fun game to watch.
Not popular in the States.
Not popular in the States. It's like, why? Like, get a bunch of NBA players, train them for 3 months and win a gold medal. So that was kind of
and wildly popular.
In like Germany. Dirk Nowitzki was going to be a handball player and stuff. So it was basically like, you know, what's going on here, America? This is an easy game. Train some athletes and let's be good. So I was – and so I was – in the story was in the works and I was at the Great Wall trailing around the Team USA basketball team on their trip to the Great Wall. And I see a guy who I'd known through kind of New York pickup basketball circles. And you know, I just kind of knew him casually, not that well. And he's like, oh, what are you doing here? And he was with another group and we're in the Great Wall of China. It's like, hey, this is great, funny. And he asked me innocently, you know, what are you working on? He's like, you know, I got this story. You know, team handball, like, why isn't America good in this? It's like, it just seems so silly. He's like, you know, I was on the 1996 U.S. team handball, Olympic team. Like, I'm an Olympic team handball player. I'm like, what?
Eureka.
It's like, what? He's like, yeah, I was in 1996. You know, as the host country, you automatically get a spot in every sport. U.S. had a handball team in 1996, and I was on the team. I'm like, are you kidding me? And so I talked to him, and da da da, and then I write the story, and it's and the handball community basically hated me for it because they're like, you're dismissing how hard the game is, and they like the attention. I mean, it got a lot of attention, but I think a lot of them were like, you're offending us. Because you're saying this is such an easy sport, and so
this is a common theme though with being a writer is you're gonna take both.
You're gonna offend somebody, but then they were so cool. They're like, hey, idiot, like you think this is so easy? Come play in a team handball tournament in Chicago.
At the time, I was living in Chicago, and you visited and you're
like,
you
know, what are you doing?
You came to a game. What are you doing?
I came to a practice and
you sheepishly said like,
I'm playing on a team handball. New York Athletic Club team handball team. And so they invited me to play and I hung out with them. We had so much fun.
Was it harder?
Oh yeah, I'd never played. Like they wanted to win and I think I got at the end of one game and like you have to be strong. Like they thought I was lefty. So apparently when you're lefty in team handball and you're on the right side of the court, your angle is better, right? Because you can kind of go in the middle.
You have a right to left defense.
No. I have a left to left.
Yes, you know, left to right.
Favoritism, left to left favoritism. And but despite all that stuff, I was terrible, and I have total respect for them. But I still think U.S. should be better team handball.
Yeah,
I
bet.
it was a lot of fun.
The Rio Olympics, you're going.
Yeah.
We have a lot of things that are going on, right? We're you know, quickly, if you could talk about you know, what are your concerns going down there? And, and what's it like covering Olympics?
You know, it's one of these things where when you're down there, it's you're worried. You don't know what's going to happen. Logistics. You
you're
know,
worried not only at this point about mosquito-borne illnesses.
But, right. You've heard about access. You're going to get enough access. Are you going to be able to get everywhere you need to go? You know, Rio's very spread out. So a lot of it's just really boring logistics stuff. Like, how am I going to get from my hotel to the Olympic Park? And what time does the bus leave? And when can I write this story? And but it winds up taking care of itself. At least that's been my experience, and hopefully this time. It just – when you're over, you're like, this is the best – this is the best time I've
had. Usually professional athletes.
No.
Because some of the best stories come out of this.
Yeah.
Because these people are very accessible.
Very – very right. So you have to find the stories that are interesting with athletes that are accessible. And I've been pretty lucky – you know,
in the fencing story,
the fencing, and you know, there's a shooting story with this guy in Athens.
Right. What do you call it?
Target shooting, pistol shooting, and in Athens, this guy, Matt Simmons, I believe his name. It's been a lot of them, but it was equivalent of like having a wide open layup to win a gold medal, and his finger moved
a hair.
And he shot a wild shot. He blew the gold medal. And then in Beijing, he does the same thing. And so I got to meet him the next day with his wife and be like, how do you handle choking twice? Like, you know. And
that was your question.
That was kind of the conceit of it. And he was so cool. Like, you know, he just gave me time. He wasn't mad that I was asking these questions. He just is honest. He's like.
It's pretty bold of you to ask a professional shooter. I don't know if I phrased it that.
I probably was very gentle around it. But like. But and him and his wife, who's also a shooter, were just their perspective was great. And so that was like one of those stories where you're in Beijing, you're at a cafe with a guy who just went through a really tough moment, but who's not in the professional glare all the time will walk you through that moment. Mm-hmm. And so those are the stories where you're like, this is money. Yeah.
But it sounds like there's a lot that is not as sexy as everyone thinks.
Yeah, no, I mean.
Getting yourself down there. I mean, you have a family. You're gone for a couple weeks.
Yeah. And you're up. I mean, you're working. The Olympics are 3 weeks of just nonstop work.
Yeah.
And you're not sleeping. You're not eating normally. You might go out and have some fun here and there. You need to kind of get out. But like, but when you're done and you see what you've done, hopefully you're like, you know, this is the ultimate. Yeah.
I want to touch on a couple more things.
Yeah.
You mentioned the blog that you wrote in Italy. And this is a hard thing to describe. I'll let you do most of the describing. But on that trip, you're a massive game show fan. and it's always fun to be around you because, and you have a particular strong affinity for Dick Clark. And on this trip, not only did you write the blog, but you would do $25,000 pyramids for the group of us.
Yes.
And Darren and Staggs won. I'm doing air quotes right now. And they're the only, you know, they won the winner's circle.
Yes.
But you're in the beginning stages of writing really terrific pyramids at the time. So I've always protested that win, I will just say. But you recently, this is amazing, are going to be on this summer. You're a contestant on the $100,000 pyramid, which is airing on
ABC
on August 28th.
August 28th.
This is for those that don't know you. This is incredible. Like, this might be the most exciting thing that you know,
yeah, it's up there.
Meeting and the kids. $100,000 pyramid hosted by Michael Strahan.
It's up there because it all started. I mean, it's just amazing how this started. It was on that trip, and I was like the show, and we were bored on these long bus rides. And I'm like, well, what can we do? And I was like, well, I don't know how we thought of this. Or I thought it was just like, let's play $25,000 pyramid, and I'll be Dick Clark, and I'll sit there and. Mm-hmm. On loose leaf, write out all these clues.
And you've since been Dick Clark.
Now it's a thing.
Any gathering. You bring your coat.
Right. I bring my little sport coat.
Your little frumpled coat.
I'm smug after the winner's circle, giving the clues that you should have given.
You're a terrifically smug Dick
Clark. I tried to be as smug as possible.
And you cuckoo, you love.
Oh, I've judged when you're given a legal clue. I've studied the rules over the years. It's been this kind
Give me a couple of the.
Well, you have to give a list that fits. So if it's things in basketball, you have to say – we can't say basket or ball, right? You have to say the hoop, the teams, the shots. Mm-hmm. You can't say, oh, it's a game that Michael Jordan plays. No, you can't be descriptive and all that kind of stuff. So I've put you guys through this ringer playing for fake money of trying to make it hard for you to get the six in 60 seconds. And none of you have done it since 1997 when Darren Stacks, and it's been a source of you guys think you're so smart, but you can't figure out these six in 60 seconds.
You're being a little smug
right now.
I'm being
smug right now.
But so here you are. You're on an actual taping of the show. And I know you're not allowed to talk about details, but the excitement was high.
Yeah. I mean, the way I got on it was I knew it was coming back, and I said, if they're going to film this in New York, I might as well apply. Why not? And I found out I was filming in New York, and they asked for a two-minute cell phone tape. And so I wrote on my – we have like a little chalkboard in the kitchen, and it was a night you guys were playing, I think. It was before watching one of your guys' games, and I like wrote all my little talking points. And so Ann was like facing me with the camera. I was looking at the chalkboard and to get my little about how I loved the game. I used to play on the, I pretended I was Dick Clark and I did this whole song and dance, and I did it in one take. Ann was like, that was perfect because I was kind of jittery and mumbling, but it was kind of like that's they
this
want
is
that
who you are.
Authentic
yeah,
thing.
Sure.
Send it in, and then on Monday morning they call me. And so I did this audition process and all this stuff. And yeah, so I did a taping, and I can't say how it went or stuff, but it was just a really, you know, unique experience.
Yeah. I can't. I'm like counting down the
it's
days.
It's June 26th is the premiere.
Premiere.
Is this Sunday. June, I don't know when this is going to air, but June 26th. And so please tune in so the ratings are good. So when it becomes August 28th, you'll be able to
see
me.
We will. I'm going to wrap up with letting you tell I've allowed people to tell a Kirill story.
Yeah.
So go ahead. And I will say.
Do I have to do his voice? Is that all right?
You can do it. Please.
I don't do a great Kirill, but it was.
And I'm sorry. I'm just going to. You have a name that all of us know.
Yes.
And it's probably isn't the story you're going to tell. But your name is Bones.
Yeah.
Now, I call you Sean because.
You're very nice.
You're a professional. But your name for a lot of people is Bones.
They don't know my real name. A lot of people don't know my real name still. When I come
back
to reunions.
That name, like a lot of us, has been given you by Coach.
Yes, Coach, that was when I got here. He's like, oh, Bones, you know.
Skin and bones.
And stuck, and I never minded it. And you know, I've kid around like our friends saying Bones. I'm like, I have a perfectly fine name. It's called Sean Gregory. and so, but it's fine. But my favorite Kirill story is not even, it's before I got here is I just kind of said I was coming, and it was maybe May or June before we started. And I'm like, he's like talking to me about my summer plans and like how I'm going to put weight on. And he's like, well, you should come down here. Maybe we'll do some working out and lift. You know, we do, you know, we never really lifted as a team back then. He's like, and what else can you do? Well, you know, have a six pack of beer every night and eat a ham sandwich. So I'm like, and he's like, no, you should really do that.
I'm serious.
Like he was serious. He was dead serious. And I think I tried to drink two beers and eat the ham sandwich, but it never worked. But yeah, he was dead serious, six pack of beer and a ham sandwich. I did my little laugh, and he's like, oh, you got to do that.
Yeah.
So that was like,
this
is who this
guy is. I
think
a lot of skinny guys got the you should drink more beer.
Yeah, that was.
Now, he would always say, which he might be ahead of his time, that don't drink soft drinks.
No, right, the sugary. And I think beer was, it's tough, yeah. You know, and he loved showing that you were tough.
I'm not going to put that on my recruiting.
You don't do that?
No,
you don't do that?
No.
It's not the 21st century way of nutrition and athleticism.
Less than brutal honesty. but no, there's an awful lot that we take from Coach.
Like what?
So telling kids the truth.
Right.
But you can say the truth in some different ways. Being a part of a team.
Yeah.
It's having a sense of the game.
Yeah.
Recruiting guys that can see and like to be a part of something.
Right.
And then, you know, I've listened to Coach tell the story in a number of different ways, but I think the history and tradition of the program is as it relates to the current players. You know, Coach is as big of a fan of the current team.
Right.
So I think he's always in the present.
Yeah. That's what I've learned about him, too, because he hates talking about the past.
And you know what? We were just – you and I were just at Frick Chemistry Cafe. Mm-hmm. If you walk with Coach to the Chemistry Cafe, I think if you asked all the different coaches, what was it – why was Princeton basketball successful? You might get equally right but different answers.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a people person.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be chatting with the woman behind the register. And she speaks Spanish, so he starts speaking Spanish. He meets somebody from Bethlehem, PA. He's like – you know, remembers high school scorer from back in the day. So he's easily relates to a lot of different kinds of people.
I think he's seeing him just mellow out and be like a grandfatherly presence is so enjoyable. I think, you know, getting out when he got out was perfect for him. You know, he knew he was ready to go. He went out to Sacramento. I think we've talked about it. It seemed like he aged. He went revert Benjamin Button. Like, he seemed like he got younger for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had his heart thing out there. And it just kind of, I think,
it's a lot easier when you're not watching me throw the ball away in 1996.
And you're the assistant. You get to work with Vlade Divac's passing and stuff like that. And so seeing his – being around him now is so much fun. And I think he made the great – he just did it right, you know. And I think it's seeing him back here and involved with you guys. And what – you know, what impresses me most about – you know, looking back, like just learning from Coach Kirill and Coach Carmody and everything is the detail. Like, I've told this story before. I just remember, like, not having a sense of, like, how much joy a coach can get out of, like, when Mitch Henderson would, like, dribble down the lane and throw, like, with his left, a one-handed, left-handed pass to the corner, right? Like, that made him so happy, you know, like, to just throw off a dribble and, like, when you're young, you're like, nobody thinks of that. You're thinking of getting to the basket, hitting threes. But those little details all add up where, like, I would sit there and be like, you know, this offense, like, works. It does work. Like, we would see it, like, even against Ivy League. And we had really good players that helped, you know, obviously elevate our team to a different level. But even against teams that prepared all the time, this stuff would still work. And against teams that didn't see you all the time, the North Carolinas and the Indianas, and just seeing us get this stuff open that you wouldn't necessarily get against the third string team because they know what you're doing, was just kind of mind blowing to me.
I use his quote a lot, but he'll say, you know, we're going down to North Carolina, we're about to play, and he'll say, I'm preparing you to win.
Yeah.
And that includes the details,
yeah,
the level of focus, the energy that you need on each possession to be very good.
Right.
Now, the offense, which you mentioned, you know, is of his design.
But, right.
The attention and the focus to detail. I was talking to John Rogers, who works at Ariel Capital in Chicago. And John says, you know, it's the focus and attention to detail.
Yeah.
That's what he talks about. So,
yeah.
I remember Scott Cacciola from the New York Times came down and did a story on Coach.
Yeah.
And he asked Coach a question, and you asked, what is it about Coach? And it's also his sense of humor.
Yes.
So he pulls out of his pocket what he's about to say. He's like, I brought some things for me to talk to you about. And he looks at his left hand. He's like, oh, no, that's my recipe for Spanish rice. He puts it back in his left. And I think it's breaking the ice the other way. Like, he puts people at ease.
Yeah, no, and even when he was going nuts and tearing his shirt off and stuff, and you look back at that stuff. I've talked to him about that. Like, he would get so mad, he'd rip his shirt off, and since then, he's like, oh, yeah, that was all for fun. You know, that was all to just, like, mess around. And, you know, he knew he was kind of playing this character a little bit, and so he's very wily in that sense. He knew what he was doing. And you know, the attention to detail, like, we never watch video. You know, like, I'm sure you guys watch – I don't know if you watch as a team, but, you know, everything's so tactical now, but – it shows that, I don't know, maybe just having to pay attention and think about those details without having it all, making it hard, I guess, maybe was a key to the
practices
team's success
as well.
Practices
were definitely harder than the games.
I mean, you tell a story about the, you know, the little glasses, the little Dixie dentist cups of water, you know, like, you know, now you do nutrition, you know, and the hour, what you're supposed to do and not do, and we'd be practicing, and there's, I love how, you know, like, it would be the little dentist cup, and, you know, and then you
quit sipping the water.
What are you doing drinking water? He'd yell at you for drinking water, yell at you for stretching. Like, it's just like, what?
Yeah. Well,
stop stretching.
Sean Gregory, so glad to spend some time together.
Mitch,
Thank you for having us.
This is really an honor, and to be on this and to think of me for all the folks that you're going to have on this great podcast, for me to be here today was really special. So thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and we're all fans.
Thanks, man.
Okay.
Fans of you
Take
guys
care.
Too. Thanks.